Hey, none of that.
This is the UVic Oral History Program interview with Specialist Fourth Class Doug Lawrence, recorded on the 15th of February at his home in Grand Forks, interviewed by Phelan Lundeberg. So, firstly, Specialist Lawrence, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
Okay, and can I just ask you to identify yourself for the record as well?
Yeah, my name is Douglas Lawrence, and I'm a citizen of Canada. I don't know if you need anything else.
No, that's just fine. Okay, well, let's get started. I think the obvious question to start this interview with is, how did a Canadian like yourself end up in Vietnam to begin with?
Yeah, well, my parents took us into Buffalo, New York in the early days in the 50s, 56, 57, and we got deported at that time back into Canada in 58. And my parents brought me back into the United States legally in 1960. We moved to the West Coast from Buffalo, New York. We moved to Long Beach, California. When I was 18, had to register for the draft just like anybody else. I lived on a green card, an alien registration, a permanent resident, but you qualify, you have to register for the draft, and I was drafted in January to report in July 16th, 1968.
And by that point, you'd already had one brother in Vietnam?
Yes, I did. My one brother, my eldest brother, my only elder brother, he was 13 months older than me, and he joined the Marines when he was 16 years old. Interesting story there. He got a girl pregnant, and his life went to pieces, so he joined the Marines.
when you were drafted, did you consider just heading back up to Canada?
I guess that was an option, and I'm sure it was an option. Although I'd done my what I call my formative years. I did my junior high school and high school while I was in Long Beach, California. I felt like an American. I lived like an American. Beach Boys and all, you know, California. It was a pretty cool place to be. My history in Canada was small. As I said, I was in Buffalo previous to that, illegally, but still an American, living as an American. My father was living illegally in Canada. In the United States. He was a Canadian. He was living illegally. He didn't get papers. My mom and my two brothers and I did, to live here legally in the United States. And he put the pressure on me. Huh? If you don't go, they might come and take me away.
So what did you know about the situation in Vietnam at the time when you got called up?
Well, of course, in 1968, it was pretty, you know, by then the war had gotten under a lot of people's skin, and there was a lot of Kent State stuff and, you know, a lot of things like that going on. But I don't know, call it naive, call it whatever a person wants to call it. I've somewhat lived my life, and I still do to a certain degree, of believing that what comes my way, and I'll have to deal with it. And I wasn't politically motivated at the time. I felt that if this is my calling, this is my calling. And what little bit I knew about it was that it was a war. My brother was there. Why couldn't I be there?
So what was, you mentioned your father's reaction. He encouraged you to go. What about your mother? What did she think about her second son?
Yeah, she wasn't heading off to the war. Yeah, she wasn't too happy about that. Although she didn't kind of talk to me about going back to Canada. She more or less took a back seat to it all and just said, well, it is what it is. My dad was in Korea in the Canadian Army. My brother Jack was in the American Marines in Vietnam in 65. What's the difference? We accept our fate.
Fair enough. So then where did you do your basic training?
I did my basic training at Fort Ord, California, beautiful Fort Ord. When I went to Fort Ord, they had an outbreak of spinal meningitis that they were dealing with. So my basic training was a little bit different than other forts in that we had to wear a white patch over the our name tag. Yes, the U.S. Army on one side, our name tag, and a white patch. And the white patch meant that on all of your uniform, meant that you could not leave the base and your restricted travel on the base. Other guys I spoke to afterwards, you know, in my service, said their basic training was they had freedom after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was like a job, a day job. They would clean up and they could go to the movie house and stuff. We couldn't. We were restricted to base for 8 solid weeks in Fort Ord.
And at that point, did you request going into the artillery, or is that just where they put you?
Well, it's funny because I just got my paperwork back the other day. I requested it and it got mailed to me. They gave me a series of tests. Because I was a Canadian when I was drafted, I got on the bus with a bunch of other guys from the LA Induction Center. We arrived in Fort Ord on the bus, and you know, by this time 20 hours had gone by and you've searched out friends and became friends with some people. And as soon as I got off the bus, I was removed from that crowd and put segregated over to the side. Now, I figured at the time that it was for my Canadian citizenship. And sure enough, that's what it was. They had made me pledge allegiance to the United States and renounce my allegiance to Canada. And that was the only way that they were going to run me through the basic training. So I was with maybe 4 other guys that were guys from Puerto Rico, things like this. And again, we had to do this special little thing. It took about 2 or 3 days. But during that, they segregated me out again and gave me extra tests. They put me in this room and showed me a bunch of movies and then questioned me on the movies and gave me a bunch of other skilled type tests. And I don't know what all that came down to, except that when I got my orders out of basic training, I got artillery, and I was extremely happy about that because there was a possibility of going to Germany because we had artillery outfits in Germany. But that didn't happen. When I got my orders out of Fort Sill after my training in artillery, I definitely got a Vietnam posting.
What was, do you feel like an outsider as a Canadian in not basic training and both in the war or?
During those years you're speaking of?
Mm-hmm.
I never felt like an outsider. I knew the lingo of California. California was my nemesis. Being in the Army, everybody from California is gay. Everybody from California is, you know, gay, or, you know, you're a surfer boy, you know. So California was, being from California was probably the, you know, the worst thing it could be.
Worse than being a Canadian.
Yes, it was. No doubt about it. People were fascinated that I was Canadian, you know, and asked me about the Great White North, whether we had toilets indoors and whether we had, you know, dog sleds and the typical stuff.
So then what was your artillery training like? What did it entail?
It was, artillery training is quite interesting because it's heavy duty math. There's a lot of extreme math in it. You know, you got to figure out azimuth and coordinates and all these other things that, so a lot of, rather than field training, a lot of classroom training. Mm-hmm. So everybody falling asleep in class and getting the neck hurting because your neck snapping and stuff. But every day, you know, 6 hours a day in the classroom. So it was a lot of like I say, classroom training, a lot of math, a lot of, you know, that kind of stuff. And then out in the field, of course, it was great to go out in the field because you're outside. We were in Oklahoma. The weather was nice. You know, it was you know, getting close to fall by then, and it was just, you know, very little outside work and a lot of indoor work. Yeah.
So, and then, how long did the training take?
Well, training and basic training in the United States at the time was 8 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and you had maybe 2 or 3 days off, and then what they call AIT training, and advanced infantry training is what it really refers to. But then they changed it to advanced individual training so they could keep the AIT thing. And then another 8 weeks in the Fort Sill. And then just as I was ready to ship out and go home for a 30-day leave before I was to go to Vietnam to report in Oakland, I was told that I had to stay another 10 days because they were going to give me training on self-propelled artillery pieces, which actually turned out to be a lot of fun because they made me a driver right away, and I had an opportunity to drive self-propelled armored vehicles, which was a gas. It was so much fun.
So then were you given the 30 days?
Yes, I was given the 30 days and spent that with my family. And, you know, I didn't have a girlfriend at the time. I had an ex-girlfriend, and we spent a lot of time together, but I didn't have a girlfriend at the time, which I was really happy to not have a girlfriend, knowing that I was going overseas.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, it was good times. I wasn't, you know, apprehensive or anxiety-ridden. I just kind of, this is what's going on, this is what's happening, and I'm okay with it, you know? Little did I know, though, I just wanted to add something to that. Little did I know that during this period of time, that 16, 17 weeks, they had been, the Army, they had been checking me out for a top secret security clearance. And they had gone to friends of mine that were schoolmates, and gone to their parents, gone to my ex-girlfriends all the way back into junior high, and gone to their parents asking about my character, and, you know, about anything else that they knew about me. And I didn't know this was going on, and they were told not to discuss this with me. I found out years later that, not really years later, I found out in Vietnam, actually. I found out that I had been put in a position to get a top secret security clearance, and I found out later that they had been questioning all these people in my life.
And were you given the top secret security clearance?
Well, that's another little story. What happened is they moved me out of the front, you know, where we were actually what they call in the shit. And I was happy to go, and moved me to a rear assignment where I was guarding. I was the main gate guard at a top secret security clearance, top secret security bunker, a top they call it. I had to question generals on their way in, you know, all the top brass, and make sure that they were who they were, check their IDs and things like this. And the reason I was there was because they were setting me up to go to Hawaii, and they were going to send me to Hawaii TDY, which means you get extra pay a day plus all your other combat pay. And, you know, all these perks, you know, they're going to give me time spent and da-da-da-da-da-da. And all I had to do was become an American citizen. If I became an American citizen, I would have had a top secret security clearance, and I would have been stationed at Fort MacArthur, which is outside of Long Beach, California, at the missile installation. I said, I can't afford, at that time, the United States didn't recognize dual citizenship, and I wasn't willing to give up my Canadian citizenship. That was, to me, my ace in the hole. I may need this later in my life, and I didn't want to give it up. So they gave me 36 hours to think about it. At the end of 36 hours, they asked me if I was willing to give it up and go to Hawaii. I said no. Within 10 hours, I was shipped back to the front. They're done with me. Wow. Oh, well.
Why do you think they had singled you out for this in particular?
I don't know. It's been something in my life that I never really quite understood why I was. I mean, I was a high school dropout. I dropped out in the 10th grade and went to work full-time. I didn't have any outstanding qualifications. I wasn't a brainiac, and I wasn't you know, I wasn't connected to anybody, you know, as far as my friend's dad was a governor or, you know, I didn't have any kind of connections like that. I wasn't going to West Point, you know, it wasn't anything like that. I to this day, I don't know what got them on to me other than, because they'd already started this process early on. But when I did go in, that relates a story back to when they singled me out going to basic training. They gave me a battery of tests that I just received the scores on just recently here in the last couple of days. And I would assume because of my scores that they felt that I was trainable, that I was going to be able to be used in the nuclear missile silos in some way.
So when you were being shipped off to Vietnam, before you got there, what were your expectations of what it would be like? And then I guess the second part of that question is, how did the expectations of it differ from the reality?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that I never, that question never arose in my mind. I never, even to this day, I never thought, well, it was way different than what I thought it was. Fortunately, I think for me, I was a scout. And ever, for instance, a very young age, I was a scout and loved it. Mm-hmm. Went camping in Pennsylvania, Altoona, Pennsylvania, every summer and spent 3 weeks down there and loved that outdoorsy type, you know, camaraderie. Everybody's dressed the same, you know, I don't know, something felt comfortable about it. Mm-hmm. And I never questioned it. I didn't think. When I was on the airplane going over, I thought, holy Jesus, man, I could die here. You know, that's the first time it really came to my mind that I could die. But I looked at every experience. I'm not trying to be philosophical here, but I looked at every experience as the next step towards the next happening. And I tried to embrace every experience without saying, the end result is going to be here. I'm here right now, and this is what's happening to me right now. And that's how I approached that whole situation. I remember being in Oakland, sitting there waiting, listening to music, you know, on this, with a bunch of 500 other GIs just sitting there in the shade. Getting on the airplane was a whole nother movement. Flying was another movement. Getting to, little sideline story, getting to Hawaii, not being able to go in and drink because I was too young to have a beer on the way over. Everybody else went in and had a beer. I wasn't allowed. I was too young.
How old were you?
I was 19 years old. You had to be 20 to drink beer in Hawaii. So a bunch of other guys were in the bar drinking beer and I was sitting outside. So I took those as situations for what they were, as themselves. And they progressed into whatever they progressed into. And I think that's why I was a survivor, because I didn't have any great expectations of something arising from what's going on right now. I would do what I had to do right now to get through what I had right now.
So then, what were your first impressions of Vietnam when you got off the plane?
Well, getting off the plane, Vietnam has a very distinctive odor to it.
Oh, I've experienced that.
And when the doors opened up on the airplane, it was like, holy man. And it was at night, and it was still 85 degrees with that odor, and I'll never forget it to this day. And the lights were shining, and we were at a military installation, but everything just had a roof on it, no walls. There was no walls anywhere, you know, and if there were walls, they were half screened and half walls, as you know.
Too hot.
And I was amazed because I hadn't seen anything like this before.
Was it your first time being out of North America?
Yes, so to speak. I mean, the family used to go to Mexico and camp every summer and camp on the beach, close to the beach. But that's Mexico. I mean, we lived in Long Beach, so it was a 2-hour drive away Tijuana and south to Rosarita Beach. And we'd hang out there, but that was all. I'd never been anywhere else. So, of course, I was kind of shocked at just the whole everything growing, everything's green, everything's lush, everything's, you know, California's like that, but not so intense. Mm-hmm. And the nighttime, with all the lights lit up, it was quite, and again, situation, now we're getting off the plane. Okay, we get off the plane. Now what? Now we're being housed here. So I was just living it by the situations and being struck for the moment, then, hey, let's go. And then, okay, everything's changing, now I'm over here. Mm-hmm. So they didn't give you much time to really soak in or have conversation with each other about, wow, look at how weird it is here. You were, okay, we're all going to line up here. Okay, we're all going to move over here. Okay, we're all going over here, you know.
And did you fly into Saigon?
Flew right into Saigon, and strangely enough, when I went back with my son, I took my son back in 2005, flew into the same airport that I flew into with the same hangars there and the same everything right there, Tansanut, you know. Right into Ho Chi Minh, yeah.
And so you would have arrived about 6 months after the end of the Tet Offensive, which is considered now by historians to be the turning point of the war. What was the general mood amongst the GIs, especially those who had been there a while? Was it still an optimistic mood, or?
Actually, just to set the record straight, I arrived about 11 months after the Tet Offensive, 10 to 11 months after the Tet Offensive, 9, 10, 11 months, somewhere in there. Because I arrived just in late December, middle December, the 19th of December.
No, my mistake. Must have fudged my facts somehow.
Well, that's okay. But nonetheless, I noticed that there was a weariness. Mm-hmm. Although, when you arrive, you're with brand new guys. FNGs. FNGs, if you don't mind, fucking new guys, right? So... We're all FNGs, right? And there, you don't see any of that weariness. You know, everybody's excited. Everybody's kind of, you know, up and ready to be whatever they're going to be. But once you get stationed out of the massing area, which was, for me, it was An Khe, once you get stationed out of that, then you start to see the weariness. Mm-hmm. I didn't relate it to the Tet Offensive as much as I related it to war weariness, just the everyday grind of living in a hole in the ground that's rat infested, and being bombed at night, and being, you know, at scared 95% of the time about losing your life. And that's what I put it up to right away. I thought, well, these guys are just war weary here, you know. But there was a weariness about it. And as time went on, I was in the 1st Cavalry Division, so as we all know, the 1st Cavalry Division, the 2nd and the 7th, sat down in the field and refused to go, refused to move. And so the protests had started mm-hmm. in the year that I was there, in 69.
Do you find there was any tension between the new guys who were coming in and those who had been there, been in the shit for a while, you'll excuse the language?
No, because the guys that were, and let's use that language, because it is important to identify that out of the 2.5 million GIs that were in Vietnam, 10% of them were in the shit. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them are Vietnam vets, but throughout Vietnam vets, unless you're in the shit, don't talk to me about being a vet. You know, there's this feeling now here, homeside. There's that feeling. When you're there, the tensions between the guys that were rotating or the guys that had time left and the new guys was only that they could fuck with us. And I'm just going to talk now, okay?
Yeah, please.
They could fuck with us and they could make our lives a little bit more scary than it needs to be. And they would do that to you. And I think it was an endearment, mm-hmm. and it was a learning process to harden you at the same time, to put you in a situation that anything can happen to you at any given moment, and we're going to show you that. If it's not happening right now, we'll do something to you to scare the shit out of you. So, no, there wasn't the tension between the vets that were there and had some time in and the new guys. There was a huge amount of tension between the black and the white. Mm. An incredible amount of tension. Blacks didn't hang with whites unless they absolutely had to, and vice versa. Although one of my best friends was black and we hung out together and we both took the rap for that everywhere we went. Why are you hanging with that black dude? Why are you hanging with that white dude? We didn't care. We just said, hey, we like each other, you know.
Fair enough.
Yeah, we had to live through that.
So where were you posted? Were you in Saigon and then would go out to where you needed to be from there?
No, how the first cab worked is, I guess, you know, the first cab is an air mobile unit.
Mm-hmm. Using helicopters.
Helicopters everywhere they go. They're famous for this. But what they did personally with me is they took me out of Benoit and moved me to Ankay by C-130. C-130 is a cargo airplane, a large cargo airplane, and all it has on the decking is these pallets that are 12 by 12 pallets, and they slide them up into the plane, and they're all on tracks, and they can move them in any direction that they want. No seats, no nothing. They just put 500 guys in this plane, and you're sitting on these aluminum pallets, watching that your fingers don't get knocked in between the pallets, and ship you off up to Ankay. Mm-hmm. Ankay was the, trying to think of the base's name, really. It was Ankay, but the base is, I'll come up with the name later. Right. But Camp Evans, that was headquarters for the 1st Cavalry Division.
And just roughly, whereabouts would that be in relation to, say, Saigon?
Yeah, that would be, if you went up the coast, Saigon, if you went up the coast, you would probably be just south. You'd be center of the country. You would be probably just south of what would be on the coast, Da Nang.
All right.
So, yeah, you'd probably be about, how many clicks? Maybe 100. Maybe like 225 clicks from Saigon. Mm-hmm. But in not quite the Central Highlands, still in the lowlands. But you know.
So and then your job in the artillery would be to support these mobile helicopter units, these cavalry units.
Yeah. What happens? I mean, really, I'm surprised that most of our support was we were supporting 101st Airborne. 101st worst airborne, an endearment, the 82nd airborne, 1st infantry. And I can remember seeing these guys because what they would do is they would move us from LZ to LZ in support of these other army units. I was surprised that we were supporting a lot more of these other units rather than our own cavalry units. Not that we didn't. But, I just remember seeing a lot of 1st Infantry and 101st and 82nd Airborne guys around. And AmeriCal Division once in a while, stuff like that. But they would move us strategically. We would fire for them and either open up areas or support them actually while they were engaged. And then with no further notice, boom, they'd just come up one at any given moment. It could be at nighttime, it could be any time, and say, okay, we're moving out. And you would have to empty every sandbag that you filled. You'd have to do all of these monumental chores and get ready to get on the helicopter, because things had to be packed in a certain way to get lifted off by a helicopter. So the men and their one projectile that they were in charge of would have to go by Chinook helicopter, and then our gun would be, it's a 155 howitzer, our gun would be moved by a flying crane.
So by the time you arrived, were they still doing the search and destroy missions? So they'd go
locate the
VC and then call in the artillery support?
That's right. And what we would do, there was a couple of different, you know, Search and Destroy was very active by the time I got there. And what they would do is they would go out, and if they had engagement, then of course we would fire for them to support them in that engagement. But if they had no engagement, they would have ideas of what was going on, as they always did in the Search and Destroy. They just weren't out there walking around looking for something to happen. They were definitely targeting areas to go to. So what they would do if there was no engagement, they would retreat and come back to the LZ, and then we would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and every third night, because there's only three guns on the LZs, every third night we had harassment and interdictions. And as these infantry spotting places, we would fire at night and just bombard these areas during, you know, the nighttime hours. And so that went on every night. One gun or another would doing these harassment and interdiction fire missions. You hated them. You just absolutely hated them. But
it's the job.
It's the job. And those harassment and interdictions were never, ever, ever taking place while there was conflict going on with somebody. They were specifically designed to tell the enemy that we're here, we know where you are,
keep them
and
on their
we're
toes.
Showing you that we know where you are, and we're going to beat the shit out of you in the meantime.
What was the feeling that, well, naturally they were the enemies, but of the VC and the NVA, like, how were they perceived by you and your companions? Or
as gooks.
As gooks, yeah.
Yeah, can I, gotta go to the washroom.
Oh, yeah, it's no problem.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, they were gooks.